Lecture 7, Malcolm X's Quest for Liberation.
This seventh lecture in our series on the idea of freedom is called Malcolm X's Quest for Liberation. And as we move now to Malcolm X, and then in the final lecture in the series to Martin Luther King Jr., I'll continue to use, for purposes of comparison, much of what I just said in the previous lecture about Mahatma Gandhi. This is because I think that Gandhi's life, his experience, his philosophy, and especially his pursuit of freedom, serve as a kind of paradigm or conceptual framework within which we can understand better the experiences of people of color. Few who, among these people of color, try to resist racism as they did, become leaders of their people in their efforts. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King certainly became leaders in this regard, and there are striking similarities between them and Gandhi because the three of them mobilized their peoples to resist racism as effectively as any leaders in this century. Similarities are often more apparent between Gandhi and King than Gandhi and Malcolm X, because King became an advocate in America of Gandhian nonviolence. But I'd like in this lecture on Malcolm to show how he and Gandhi were alike in their similar struggles for Swaraj, that is, for an inner freedom that comes out of a quest for self-discovery. A quest inspired initially by a common fear of personal inadequacy wrought by racism. So when Malcolm's life is compared with Gandhi's, we see how racism has a cross-cultural character, influencing individuals as different as Gandhi and Malcolm in cultures as different as America and India. Because the effects of injustice and humiliation do know no boundaries. They victimize people of color the world around. And yet, unlike most victims of such abuse, Gandhi and Malcolm X found ways to liberate themselves. And the stories of their quest for self-transformation, told so well in their respective autobiographies, is the essence of the archetypal quest, the quintessential journey of the hero, a journey that may begin in fear and insecurity, but can end in the discovery of a truth, the sort of truth that can set us free. The whole concept of a quest for personal liberation is rooted in ancient Eastern and Western philosophies. In India, as we saw in the very first lecture, the journey of the self for spiritual enlightenment was a basic theme of both Hinduism and Buddhism. And in ancient Greece, the axiom that the goal of life is to know thyself was interpreted by Socrates to mean that our lives should be devoted to continuing self-examination, so that the idea of a journey or a pilgrimage to truth is synonymous with what we call the Socratic quest. If the lives of Buddha and of Socrates personify a quest for inner freedom in the ancient world, then Gandhi and Malcolm represent this, I think, for our modern era. I met Malcolm in February 1965, only 10 days before he was assassinated. I was then a graduate student at the University of London, and Malcolm came through England on his last trip abroad. I heard him give a lecture at the London School of Economics, and then I talked with him briefly after. Before this, I had only seen him on TV or read his speeches in the press. Now, watching him up close and listening to him, I found him the most powerful speaker that I had ever encountered. His presence was so intense that it conveyed a surprising dynamism and energy. And the audience, the majority of us white, felt this energy in a way that I doubt any of us had ever felt it from a lecture from one of our professors. It was as clear to me then as it is now that this kind of effect on an audience, this time an audience of students, could come only from a speaker who was absolutely authentic, impeccably sincere. And yet also it came from an orator extremely skilled at holding a group's attention. As I look at the notes that I've saved on that lecture back in 65, it surprises me how many jokes Malcolm worked into it, and how he had developed a style that alternated between sharp, painful insights on the one hand and sardonic humor on the other. His effectiveness as a speaker, I think, came partly from his unique ability to build up a real tension with a series of rapier-like stabs at white racism, and then explode the tension with humor, mocking as he would racial injustice with an absurd joke, and releasing one burst of laughter, often from us it was nervous laughter, one burst after another, creating a sort of rhythm that carried us all along together. It was the performance I felt of a maestro, and I've never witnessed one quite like it since. But it wasn't Malcolm's oratorical style that impressed me most or remained with me after. It was even more than that the content of his lecture, a lecture that began with the words, "It is only being a Muslim," he said, "which keeps me from seeing people by the color of their skin." I realized as I heard those words on that afternoon in February 1965 that I had been out of touch with the evolution of Malcolm X. The Malcolm that I had known in America 2 years earlier, before he had left the Nation of Islam, had branded all whites as devils and demons. We were all cursed because of the color of our skin. Now in 65, Malcolm was still a Muslim, but he was claiming that it was precisely because of Islam that he could affirm the truth of human brotherhood. Now he was saying this: "We don't judge a man because of the color of his skin. We don't judge you because you're white. We don't judge you because you're black. We don't judge you because you're brown. We judge you because of what you do, what you practice. So we're not against people because they're white, but we're against those who practice racism." Now, this was a Malcolm who now preached a message of separating the sin from the sinner in much the same way as Gandhi did. And he had come to a sense of religious unity, the spiritual unity of humanity, very much like Gandhi's. My discovery on that afternoon, then, was for me a revelation. But it wasn't until the publication of his autobiography a few months later that I came to understand the significance of what I had heard then in London. Because it was not just the point that Malcolm had reached by 1965 that counted. More than this, what mattered was the journey that had taken him there, a journey of personal transformation through relentless self-examination. This is what marks his profound similarity with Gandhi. Among American leaders, only Malcolm takes the meaning of Swaraj, of personal liberation, to its limit. The story of his life proclaims its significance with an unparalleled eloquence. In order to appreciate this, I think we need to review something of what was said last lecture about the stages of evolution of Gandhi's life. We saw then, you'll recall, that Gandhi, like Malcolm, was born into a deeply religious family, and his childhood was shaped by the morality that was conveyed to him by his parents. Yet while his was an ostensibly stable childhood background, Gandhi says that he himself was filled with fears. Fears of ghosts, of the dark, of his place in a colonized India. All of this left him with torment, torment over his own weaknesses and inadequacies. And as he sought to strengthen himself, to gain self-respect, he chose to identify not with his own India, because India was a conquered culture, but with the British, because they were the lords of India, powerful, masculine, dynamic rulers who happened also to be white and racist. The English rulers characterized their Indian subjects as immoral, irresponsible, immature, needing British control and domination. Gandhi swallowed this whole racist doctrine to the point of being driven to emulate the British in every way, to try, as he said, to become truly an English gentleman. Now, this important stage in Gandhi's journey of imitating the colonizer by adopting British modes of behavior lasted for decades of Gandhi's life, until his late 30s, and it didn't end until he learned a vital truth. This truth was that no matter how well he practiced British law, or how fashionably he dressed, or how mature and responsibly he behaved, or how eloquently he spoke English, he still could not change the color of his skin. The implications of this fact, that is, the full extent of British racism, were somehow not clear to him until 1906, with the trauma of the Zulu Rebellion and his unexpected identification, not with the British, but with black Africans in the midst of that massacre. It was this brutal slaughter of blacks by whites that drove Gandhi away from his emulation of the British and into a virulent form of separatism. This was a separatism so sweeping that, in fact, it went far beyond what Malcolm had ever preached, because Gandhi denounced all of modern Western civilization as evil and satanic. He wanted the destruction of everything that Western civilization had produced and used as its agents of domination, from railroads and telegraph to law and medicine. Indian civilization he presented as infinitely superior because it had Hinduism, and Hinduism as he presented as an exclusive religious truth. We often think of Malcolm as an extremist, and somehow the term extremism doesn't seem to apply to Gandhi. But this is mistaken. In his early 30s, Gandhi was as an extreme and Anglophile as any Indian in the British Empire. And then after the Zulu massacre in 1906, he became an extreme Anglophobe, arguing that India's redemption could come only from driving out all remnants of Western civilization, because Western civilization was rotten to the core. As we saw in the last lecture, the meaning of Swaraj became clear to Gandhi only in April 1919, with the massacre of 400 innocent Indians by the British at Amritsar. This might have increased his separatism, convincing him that English racism was irremediable, but it didn't. Instead, the Amritsar massacre had the opposite effect on Gandhi. He suddenly understood, as a result of the slaughter, that the way out of this mutual dehumanization for both colonizer and colonized was not through greater polarization, but through transcendence of it. And with that realization, Gandhi traveled in his journey a giant step from exclusivity to inclusivity, a personal victory that ultimately became political when the British left India to the Indians in 1947 without firing a shot after centuries of British domination. Now, what has this got to do with Malcolm? I think that Malcolm's autobiography, like Gandhi's autobiography, shows that these two leaders offer us models of how to deal with racism and racist domination. Lessons that are relevant today in the midst of our urban nightmares of racial violence in America. As relevant as they were when they were assassinated. These lessons, I think, are apparent in at least three striking parallels between Malcolm and Gandhi. First, their early childhood experiences were both influenced by parental religious training, and yet for both of them, religion did not rescue them from personal insecurity and terrible childhood fears. In Malcolm's case, his anxieties and his insecurities were exacerbated by the violent racism that pursued him and his family wherever they went. Perhaps this was because his father was such a vocal and effective advocate of Marcus Garvey's Black Liberation Movement at that time. But at any rate, Malcolm tells us in the opening chapter of his autobiography, entitled Nightmare, how the Ku Klux Klan forced his family to move from Omaha, Nebraska, where Malcolm was born, to Lansing, Michigan, where his father was murdered when Malcolm was only six. And yet this trauma didn't turn Malcolm against whites. On the contrary, as his own mother's hold on his family became more and more shaky, Malcolm searched for security among white families and in white schools. Just as Gandhi, in fear, turned to the English for security, so Malcolm, for the same reason, began to emulate white standards and white models of behavior. In the chapter of his autobiography, appropriately titled Mascot, Malcolm relates how in his Lansing Elementary School, a school practically all white, he was treated like an exotic pet. He says, a pink poodle. And he says more than that, that he liked it. He was proud of how he was treated because all he wanted was acceptance from the white kids and white teachers. And then, in eighth grade, where he was the only black child, there came a moment of truth that jarred him, aggravating his insecurities in the way that racism often does. Malcolm was smart enough to be among those at the top of his class, and he liked especially his English teacher, Mr. Ostrowski. But one afternoon, when Malcolm was alone with Ostrowski, the teacher asked Malcolm about his goals in life, and Malcolm replied that he would like to be a lawyer. The teacher, with a brutal directness, said that this wasn't a realistic goal for a, quote, nigger, unquote, and he should try carpentry instead. Malcolm says that that remark stayed with him for the rest of his life. He was hurt most by the sheer injustice of the comment. The injustice that white kids in that class, not as smart as he was, could nevertheless be encouraged to aim higher, as this teacher so often did. So he learned, like Gandhi, that whatever he did, he was still defined by the color of his skin. But the path of emulation was too tempting to be left so quickly, and Malcolm relates his varied but relentless efforts at denying his own color by trying to appear lighter. There's the graphic account of lightening and straightening his hair by burning his head with lye. Not until much later, he says, would he realize how his hair conking was an attempt to deny his own identity by denigrating his blackness. Now, if the first parallel between Gandhi and Malcolm X concerned their early struggles with childhood insecurities and consequent attempts to resolve them through emulation of white society, then the second parallel comes with their move to separatism. As soon as they both realize that the path of emulation won't take them any further in their quest, but will only further their own self-humiliation, they seek another route. Both go now for religious extremism. Gandhi for a form of Hindu nationalism, and Malcolm, of course, to the Nation of Islam. The fact that Malcolm converted to Islam when in prison is significant because in prison he had reached the end of all hope of emulation. He had played out the role that was assigned to him and expected of him by white culture, that of ultimately pimp, hustler, and thief. At age 20, he was given a 10-year prison sentence for burglary. Later, he says that prison was indispensable in his quest because without it, he may never have found Islam, the event that totally changed his whole course of direction. It was 2 years into his prison sentence, in late 1948, that Malcolm had a visit from his brother, Reginald. Reginald was a member of the Nation of Islam, and he described to Malcolm the doctrine of black separatism in such compelling terms that it left Malcolm fired with a kind of inspiration that he'd never felt before. He learned the history of the movement now, that the Nation of Islam had been founded in Detroit in 1931 by W.D. Ford, and then it was taken over by Elijah Muhammad in 1934, and now it was swelling in members with an exclusively black membership that rediscovered the ancient glory of its African heritage. The enemies Malcolm learned from Reginald were whites, and when he heard that, he says, he suddenly realized how true it was, because at every step of his life, he had been dehumanized by white culture, and indeed enemy was the right word. Now, as we look at this moment of conversion, we realize that this kind of polarization of good guys versus bad guys occurs in every form of extremist doctrine, whether it's religious or political or cultural. After Malcolm escaped this way of thinking, he deplored it as oversimplified and dangerous. By the time I heard Malcolm talk in London, he was openly denouncing the Nation of Islam for its straitjacketed thinking, saying that in those years as a follower of Elijah Muhammad, he had behaved like a zombie, a robot. And yet, bad as the doctrine seemed later on down the road to Malcolm, the inspiration that it initially gave him in prison in 1948 was profound. It gave him an intellectual curiosity that drove him to devour books on history and philosophy, literature and the social sciences with an uncanny zeal. His omnivorous appetite, when we look at the books that he records having read at that time, makes his prison reading lists look like Columbia University's core curriculum. Considering the fact that he had left school early and spent so much of his adolescence on the streets, his achievement now was a phenomenon of learning. As he absorbed one volume after another, he realized what he had not appreciated before, that he loved what he was doing. He loved it because he had a remarkable memory, exceeded only by his curiosity about all subjects. And most of all, he had a passion. He had now a purpose in life. He could not have accomplished such feats of learning as he did in prison if he hadn't been riding high on a new tide of identity. And as this ideological high surged through him, and as he stayed up night after night to conquer another philosophy, it recalls Gandhi, who was so fired in 1909 by his passion of separatism that Gandhi recalls writing his first statement of it on a boat, and his right hand becoming so paralyzed with fatigue that he had to switch to his left in order to continue writing. The original manuscript of Gandhi's book appears as though it was written by two different people, so different the handwriting. And this was Malcolm too. Malcolm working at a fever pitch, unable to stop. And in the months and years that now sped by in prison, he acquired his education. Before this, Malcolm had felt, we might say, every kind of high imaginable. But none sustained him as this one did. So when in 1952 he was released from prison after serving 6 years of his sentence, he was still on that high, and it took him straight to becoming Elijah Muhammad's leading minister in the Nation of Islam. Now, Malcolm's separatist period lasted from 1952 until he left the Nation of Islam on March 12, 1964. During these 12 years as a black Muslim, as members were called, especially by the press, Malcolm during this time consolidated an exclusivist ideology, and he preached it all over America with increasing effectiveness to ever-growing crowds. The main thrust of his separatism came with an emphatic rejection of integration. Integration as advocated by white and black liberals alike. And its affirmation, of course, of black nationalism, which meant separate communities entirely controlled by black economic and political interests. This call for black autonomy compared to Gandhi's demand that Indians must control their own national destiny. Though, while it was always plausible that the British could leave India to its hundreds of millions of native people, it was never feasible, of course, for American blacks to have their own nation. There were two aspects of Malcolm's separatism that held particular appeal because they were grounded in the real passions of that separatist doctrine. First, there was the denunciation of whites as demonic. And this came together with a glorification of African culture, the basic separatist dichotomy that appealed to Malcolm from the start and which he had preached so forcefully. And second, there was Malcolm's differentiation between two groups within the American black community, the black liberals, whom he despised, and the radicals, or the radical beliefs, that he felt represented most blacks in America. He ingeniously saw these two groups as analogous to the house Negro and the field Negro in the days of American slavery. In a speech that he called Message to the Grassroots, he develops this distinction between these two types of Negroes and his scorn for the house Negro or the moderate liberal black shows how emphatically he rejects emulation of whites now in this period. Once again, there is a direct parallel with Gandhi, who opposed the Indian liberal for identifying too closely with the British and believed that most Indians shared his radical aspirations of getting the British out of the country forever. When Malcolm says in this speech that the house Negro loved his master, enjoyed life in the big plantation house, and didn't have the sense to distinguish his own identity from the white slave owner's image of him, Malcolm is deriding Uncle Tom's, just as Gandhi criticized Anglophiles in his nationalist movement. So this was the similarity of their separatism. And now the question is how they managed to transcend it, especially Malcolm. Because I did say that there are three fundamental points in common between Gandhi's and Malcolm's quests for Swaraj, or for personal and political liberation. The first, as we saw, concerned their early search for identity that led them to emulation of whites or to an acceptance of the inferior roles assigned to them by white culture. The second, when they both embraced separatism as they rejected both white culture and glorified their own people of color. And now third, they are similar in their final movement from separatism or exclusivity to inclusiveness. As I've said, Gandhi's realization of inclusiveness came with the Amritsar massacre, and from 1919 until his death in 1948. During that time, Gandhi preached and practiced that inclusiveness until it became the hallmark of his philosophy, especially, of course, his idea of nonviolence. Whereas Gandhi had almost 30 years to demonstrate his inclusiveness and practiced it in the Great Salt March and in the Calcutta Fast that we've discussed, Malcolm was assassinated at age 39 and so was given less than a year to consolidate his last step to Swaraj. We need to emphasize that if Gandhi had been assassinated at age 39, we would not be studying Gandhi today, or at all interested in him, because he had achieved so little by that age. In fact, Malcolm and Martin Luther King Jr. were both assassinated at the same age, age 39. And it is extraordinary when we think of how much both of those two black American leaders managed to pack into such a short lifetime. Stages of development, progress towards Swaraj that we can barely imagine if we apply that to Gandhi. It is the way in which then they live such accelerated lives in their path to Swaraj that is remarkable. Malcolm's journey in this final stage remained incomplete, and he never fulfilled its promise, the promise of full inclusivity in the way that Gandhi did. And yet the fact that he moved so fast in 1964 is remarkable. Now we want to look closely at the way in which that movement occurred. First of all, Malcolm, a moralist to the core, a person who was so strict in terms of his own character, insisting on fidelity, truth, honesty, and insisting too that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the leader of his movement, embodied these virtues. Malcolm, as he says in his autobiography, was not just amazed, he was traumatized when he found that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was not in fact so honorable, particularly in his marital vows. So from Malcolm's point of view, when the charge of hypocrisy became true, when he learned that his leader, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, had engaged in indecent conduct, he felt that, as he says in his autobiography, the whole universe stopped. The sun, the stars, and the moon stood still. So much of a trauma was that. It led Malcolm to a phase of terrific self-examination. And in that period of self-examination came not just his rejection of the leadership of the Nation of Islam, but even more than that, his rejection of the rigidity of separatism that was expressed by the Nation of Islam, especially in its blanket condemnation of whites. And so while Elijah Muhammad lost his credibility, the Nation of Islam's credibility went along too, and with it the whole gospel of separatism, of exclusivity. And so Malcolm, in this moment of truth, casts off the essence of the nation, and that is its demonology. He publicly resigns from the Nation of Islam, denouncing not only the infidelity of the leadership, but his, Malcolm's, own fanaticism during his long black Muslim period. And then, after having left the nation, he matched this tremendous inner journey that he had experienced with an outer journey. He left the country for a pilgrimage to Mecca. And it was on that pilgrimage, he says, that he discovered the truth, that the key category, which we must think of, is not race or even nation. It's rather humanity. He saw people in the Middle East, he says, who were kind and gentle and caring, who had white skins. And as he reflected on that, and that moment of truth sunk in, his humanism, his inclusivity was born. I think when we look at Malcolm's autobiography, we want to look then most carefully at the way in which the movement occurs, from the time he loses faith in Elijah Muhammad to the trauma that then ensues, and then Malcolm's rejection of one element after the other, especially, as I said, the demons preached by that movement. And then finally we look at Malcolm's search, a search which, interestingly enough, takes him for religious reasons on a pilgrimage to Mecca. And as he goes to Mecca, he discovers, he says, for the first time, that white faces didn't necessarily equal racism. And so 2 days before his assassination, Malcolm describes to a friend his years under Elijah Muhammad in these terms. He said, "The sickness and madness of those days, I'm glad to be free of them." It is right that he should have used the word free, because this is indeed the point. He did free himself. If freedom means liberation from dogmatism, then Malcolm liberated himself from the Nation of Islam, just as Gandhi did from the chauvinism of his own exclusivist period. But in this respect, we might say, if we compare Gandhi and Malcolm still again, Malcolm achieved even more than Gandhi, even though he had such a short time to do it in, because Malcolm did manage to come from so far. In a remarkable eulogy for Malcolm, written by his good friend Ossie Davis, the very essence of what I'm trying to say in this lecture is conveyed. Ossie Davis tried to convey the distance that Malcolm had traveled on his quest. And he said this: Malcolm had been a criminal, an addict, a pimp, and a prisoner. He was a racist, and he was a hater. He had really believed the white man was a devil. But all this changed, and Malcolm became free. No one who knew him, Ossie Davis says, before and after his trip to Mecca, could doubt that he had completely abandoned racism, separatism, and hatred. It can't possibly be said better than that. And this remark captures all that Gandhi meant by Swaraj, by the quest for personal liberation. Although Gandhi could hardly have understood the many different paths that Malcolm took to get there, as an addict, a pimp, a criminal. But I think that there was one thing that Gandhi would have understood about Malcolm at this final, in this final period especially. And that's the way in which Malcolm at the end spoke about truth. Whereas earlier in the Nation of Islam, Malcolm seemed convinced that he possessed the truth because Elijah Muhammad and his doctrine were infallible, after he left the nation, Malcolm spoke of pursuing the truth rather than possessing it, trying to be open-minded in search of new ideas and interpretations of American society. And as we look through the texts, philosophies set forth by both Western and Eastern political and social theorists, we can perhaps group these theorists into two. One we might call truth pursued, and the other truth possessed. Because those who are certain, in an infallible sense, that they possess the truth, are those who see, with Plato, a set of ideal forms up there in the heavens which we must strive to know. And those who pursue the truth, beginning perhaps with Aristotle, but certainly articulated in our era best by Gandhi, those who pursue the truth see themselves as on a pilgrimage. Malcolm was on that pilgrimage. His view of truth was a Gandhian view of truth, and it's characteristic of the way one's thinking opens up as the journey assumes broader and deeper significance. Now, this lecture has stressed the similarities between Gandhi and Malcolm because I believe that together they represent for America, for India, for the world, remarkable examples of leaders who pursued freedom as more than just political or economic autonomy. That is, they saw freedom in personal terms as a Socratic quest to know thyself. Yet, there was a part of Malcolm's thought and leadership that remained until the end very different from Gandhi's. And this was Malcolm's refusal to adopt the idea of nonviolence. For most of his public life, Malcolm was opposed to Martin Luther King's theory and practice of nonviolence. Malcolm advocated violence as self-defense, arguing that blacks must protect themselves and achieve their goals by any means necessary. This distanced him from both Gandhi and from King, of course, as we'll see in the next lecture, because Gandhi and King both adopted a belief in nonviolence as a personal creed as well as a political strategy. For this reason, we know how King would have deplored the violence that has engulfed America, especially urban America, taking such an unusually high toll among African American youths today. We cannot know for sure how Malcolm would have responded to the problem of violence today. We do know that he, more than any national leader of this century, had been there, had not just seen but lived ghetto violence at its worst, and had he not died by violence, would be among us to offer his voice. And we know, too, how fervently we need his voice today in our quest for inclusivity. Because Malcolm knew hatred and anger so intimately, because of that, he shows us how not to get hung up on them. Because in the end, he would say, they inhibit self-discovery by making us blind to the openness of life. Malcolm then, at the end, challenges us with his capacity for change. And his example argues, his life argues, that in this capacity for change lies hope for a better future.